interpenetrate, but all space interpenetrates.
When it says, do you sit in one jewel, do you sit in all jewels?
Mm-hmm.
When it says they reflect each other, does it mean, wouldn't it mean if you sat in one jewel, you can be reflected in others, but you're not actually in the middle? Or is that the whole metaphor more of the fact that it's like an infinite possibility?
Yeah, and I think you pointed out like a central flaw, right? I mean, we talked about this before too. You lean on metaphors too hard and they collapse, right? And so a flaw with that, and also with the mirror, right? In the mirror, there is one real Buddha in the room, and then all the other ones are images, right? So if you break all the mirrors, you're still left with the one real Buddha. But from this view, from this vision of reality, there is no real Buddha. There's only the images of the Buddhas, right? There's only the totality of all the images. So the person that's reflected in the other jewels, there's only the image, right? There is no real original source. It's only like infinite images interreflect. It's all smoke and mirrors, right? There's no real, will the real Buddha please step forward kind of thing. Not going to happen. Right, so I think that's where it breaks down, because yeah, in this example, there is one real guy who's in one, and then all the other ones are images. But this wants to say that no, in actual fact, even the real guy that's in the one is just another reflected image.
So it's what they want us to take away from that. It's just that when you're looking at reality, there's no way to differentiate
between white and space. Well, no, it's more than that, because what it's saying is that they're all distinct and they're all one at the same time. So it wants to simultaneously like keep the oneness of everything and then also the individual distinctness. So like this like whiteboard marker is this very whiteboard marker. It really is this, but it's also everything else, and everything else is this too. So it's not saying that like this isn't real, and what's real is this oneness that's like whitewash, everything just one, right? And it's not saying that everything is just individually itself real. It wants to say that it's simultaneously what it is, and then also everything else. And in another sense too, it's like all the rest of reality, all time and space, is just as dependent on this as it is on everything else. So take this away, and all of reality, collapses, right? Which means that, in religions you see this again and again and again, right? There was the good old days, and then in the future they'll come again, but right now things kind of suck, right? So there was Jesus, there was a second coming, there was Muhammad, and there'll be the Messiah, there was the Buddha, and then like way, way in the future there's going to be the next Buddha. But according to this view, every point in time and space is just as sacred as any other point in time and space. And that also there's a kind of immediate access to like that awakened, omniscient Buddha mind. It's like right here, right now. We don't have to wait for the future. We don't have to sort of hearken to the past. Technically speaking, we have immediate access to the whole shebang. Right?
Do you watch Rick and Morty?
I know of it. Yeah, I know of it. I think I've seen one or two episodes.
He has control over all time and space.
Which one? The mad scientist?
Science.
Yeah, Morty. Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. I'll have to watch more of that. It's quite funny. Yeah. It's pretty far out there. But anyway, I think getting a grasp on it does definitely stretch the limits of one's imagination. Okay, so some of the important models that we're not going to go into all the details today, but I'll just put them up here. So we have emptiness and relativity. We have the three natures. We have the four realms. Then we have the 10 mysterious gates, which are actually 12. Maybe I'll ask you on the quiz, how many mysterious gates are there, really? Let's see who gets that one right. There's 10, psych, 12. Okay, so right, okay, so what's important to realize that emptiness and relativity are kind of interdependent concepts. So emptiness, again, remember, emptiness is empty of self-nature, which means everything is relative, which means everything's sort of interdependent. They use different terms, this interpenetration, non-obstruction, and they also use the term relativity. So, for example, true to the Mahayana notion, Huayan asserts that emptiness means that all dharmas, that is factors, elements, phenomena, things, sure, in Chinese, lack essence or self-nature, svabhava. Thus, for Huayan, emptiness does not mean absence or non-existence, nor is it apart from existing things. Emptiness itself is not an entity. Okay, there are three ways that Huayan expresses the idea of emptiness in a positive way, as relativity, as interdependence, and as impermanence. From the point of view of relativity, we can see that things do not have fixed, self-defined natures of their own. What they are depend on their relationship to other things, right? So things like hot depends on cold, night on day, father depends on someone having a son, etc., etc. Okay, then I use the example here of a pencil, which is kind of what I already did with the whiteboard marker, in the sense that for a pencil to exist, basically everything else needs to exist, right? Because there's these interconnecting webs of causality and conditioning, not moving throughout all time and space, and not in a linear kind of space-time way that we understand it, but as this kind of, I like to sort of describe it as a kind of five-dimensional hypersphere of time and space, right? So that every point in that sphere contains the totality. And so there's mutual causality. So the future and the past have as much causal efficacy on the present as the present does on the future and the past. And so it's all interlinked. Now, the three natures, I think it's important to realize when we look at the three natures that this is a model that's borrowed from the consciousness-only school. So this gets back to that idealism we were talking about before. And so, according to three natures, the first nature is pure imagination, then there's relative nature, and then there's the absolute nature. So pure imagination is the mentally constructed world that maintains the existence of real solid objects such as tables, chairs, trees, people. Okay, right? This is the deluded way of thinking. This is kind of where we're all at, right? That we think that there's a real world out there of objects and stuff, right? So relative nature is a world constructed through the senses, consciousness, and sense data. This is a world based on causes and conditions. Now, according to early Buddhism, the ultimate truth is a relative level of dependent arising of real existent dharmas constantly transforming every instant. Okay, this is what I talked about before, how those early philosophers said, okay, you know, tables, chairs, medium-sized dry goods, people are not real, but the basic building blocks that add up to make those things are real. Like, so for the five aggregates that make up the person, their form, sensations, perceptions, their karmic conditioning and their consciousness, those things are real, momentary, flicking in and out of existence, but they are real and they combine to kind of create this illusion or delusion that there's a real person that exists separate from those. Okay, so that's the relative nature. That's number two. So the absolute nature, the highest nature from the Mahayana point of view, is the absolute nature of emptiness, that everything lacks independent existence, including dharmas. Therefore, all talk of dharmas only represents the conventional level of truth. The ultimate truth of the absolute nature of reality transcends all words and concepts. Now, when we look at the four realms of reality, basically, it's these two realms, the realm of principle and the realm of phenomena, and then they add two more, which are the non-interference of Li and Shur. So the non-interference of principle and phenomena, and then the non-interference between the different phenomena, or the sure. So, realm one, okay. Sorry, back up. They order them differently. So this is actually one, this is two. So, realm one is of the phenomena. Realm two is the noumena. So it says, realm one, the realm of phenomena, is our ordinary realm of objects, persons, space, and time. Realm two is the noumenon, or the realm of principle, and represents the ultimate emptiness, insubstantiality, or the essencelessness of realm one. So this one is the ultimate emptiness of the phenomenal realm. Now, realm three is the non-interference between noumena and phenomena, is the identity of existence and emptiness. So it's basically saying these two realms are identical to each other. This is the idea that the relative or conditioned nature of things is not opposed to their absolute emptiness. Without their emptiness, things could not exist interdependently. This is clearly evident in the impermanence of things. Say, the noumenon in any particular phenomenon is the same in all other phenomena. So basically it's saying, my emptiness is the same as your emptiness and everybody else's emptiness. Which goes back to what I said before, that in fact, we all share the same, and we all share the same essence, and that is what? That we don't have an essence. So our lack of having an essence is the essence that we all share. Okay? Now, what you find then, paradoxically, though, is that neither of these two can exist without the other. So there is no principle without phenomena, and there are no phenomena without the principle. Because you need things to be empty, right? In order to have emptiness, you need things that are empty. Because emptiness is always about the emptiness of particular things. But you couldn't even have... So in order to have emptiness, you need to have things. But things couldn't exist and interrelate and mutually influence each other if they weren't empty. So emptiness depends on the things, and the things depend on their emptiness. And then finally, the fourth one is this non-interference of phenomena with each other, which is kind of what we already talked about, how that they can, the one can contain the all, and the all can contain the one. Okay, so I'll let you read about the 10 mysterious gates. I'll just mention the 11th and 12th gate of the 10 mysterious gates, the anomalous 11th and 12th, because I think this gives some idea of what we were talking about before. So the 11th gate, apparently, is the purity and mixture of the stores containing all qualities. Okay, this means that Every aspect of Buddhist teaching contains all other teachings. In this way, the teaching of the perfection of generosity, for example, contains all the other teachings, and all the other teachings are also about generosity. So this is saying, extending this idea of interpenetration so that every point of the Buddhist teaching contains the totality of Buddhist teaching. And then the 12th gate is of creation only by the operation of mind. All right, this is getting back to the idealism we were talking about before. Here we see the doctrine of mind only. The three worlds are unreal, just the production of one mind. So that would seem to indicate that Li is this kind of like a universal mind, or the Dharmadhatu is this kind of universal mind. It's kind of a universal mind that's, it's like a universal mind that's empty of any kind of content, and so its content is supplied by the phenomena. Because, in a way, because the Buddha mind would be like God is for Barclay. Because no, it's not controlling and it's not creating, because you have karma that's doing that independently. There's one thing, because karma goes back to ancient India, and you read about karma, and they, like, for some reason it was like everyone just accepted that karma must be true, that time is beginningless. It's like, who came up with karma? It's like one of those questions, you don't ask that, it just is, right? So, but Buddha mind, a Buddha is supposed to be omniscient, right? And so in order to know everything, in order to have an omniscient mind, it kind of, in a way, makes that mind be the container of everything. Because, you know, for Barclay, the reason why we know things can exist is because God's always perceiving them, right? Because without it, then you know, it's like, I don't know that the whiteboard there can exist, but I can rest assured because God, well, that's sort of what Buddha mind does, but not with all the kind of, didn't create the whole thing to begin with. That said, though, what we're saying before, how, you know, with emptiness, you have a mastery over reality, so Buddhas can create whole, like, worlds just out of their minds, but the whole all time and space, they're not, there's no creator that's apart from that. So you get into other, like, other forms of Hinduism, they say, like, there's Shiva or something, like the supreme creator who is pure consciousness, which is a lot more than like the Barclayan God, because in that case it was that it's intentional design. God created it, Shiva and Shakti, the goddess, together. But in Buddhism, they avoid the whole creator God thing. It's like, no, you can't go there. So. All right, so I'll just end up reading my summary, because I'm quite proud of my summary. And I think it puts this whole thing into a, like, kind of a wider context a bit. And then we'll stop there. Okay, so perhaps a useful way to view Huayan Buddhism is as the result of devout and intellectually gifted Chinese Buddhists attempting to come to grips with the visionary world of the Huayan Jing, that's the Avatamsaka Sutra, or the Flower Ornament Scripture. The Flower Ornament Scripture does not provide a systematic philosophical exposition of its worldview. It prefers to show and not tell about reality through its elaborate and extremely ornate descriptions of a psychedelic cosmos filled with infinite numbers of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and worlds, all interpenetrating and interreflecting each other. This vision of reality was unlike anything Chinese intellectuals had ever conceived. In an attempt to understand and explain this Buddhist vision of the cosmos and the spiritual path, the Huayan philosophers wrote commentaries and treatises on the Huayan Jing and brought to bear their analytical skills in an attempt to systematize and rationalize this vision into coherent form for the Chinese audience. Thus we see the use of concrete metaphors, of rooms with reflecting mirrors, golden lions, celestial nets, and the development of models such as the four realms, the three natures, and the ten mysterious gates, as means of transforming the flower ornaments mystical vision of reality into a coherent and systematized philosophy. Moreover, we see in these metaphors and models the Chinese emphasis on harmony so important to Taoists and Confucians. Although Huayan was largely the creation of intellectual elites and suffered a fatal blow during the Tang Dynasty persecution of Buddhism in the mid-9th century, that's 842 to 845, Huayan philosophy continued to exert an influence in Chinese thought, especially in the later developments of Chan, to which we now turn. Chan being the Chinese name for Zen. Okay, so next time we will discuss Chan. I was...